This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Welcome to Night Vale, a novel by Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner. Performed by Cecil Baldwin. Guest starring Dylan Marin, Retta, Therese Plummer, and Dan Bittner. The history of the town of Night Vale is long and complicated, reaching back thousands of years to the earliest indigenous people in the desert. We will cover none of it here. Suffice it to say that it is a town like many towns, with a city hall and a bowling alley, the Desert Flower Bowling Alley and Arcade Fun Complex, and a diner, the Moonlight All Night Diner, and a supermarket, Ralph's. And, of course, a community radio station, reporting all the news that we are allowed to hear. On all sides, it is surrounded by empty desert flatness. It is much like your town, perhaps. It might be more like your town than you'd like to admit. It is a friendly desert community, where the sun is hot, the moon is beautiful, and mysterious lights pass overhead while we all pretend to sleep. Welcome to Night Vale. 1. Pawn shops in Night Vale work like this. First, you need an item to pawn. To get this, you need a lot of time behind you. Years spent living and existing, until you've reached a point where you believe that you exist, and that a physical item exists, and that the concept of ownership exists, and that, improbable as all those are, these absurd beliefs line up in a way that results in you owning an item. Good job. Nicely done. Second, once you believe you own an item, you must reach a point where you need money more than you need the item. This is the easiest step. Just own an item and own a body with needs and wait. The only pawn shop in the town of Night Vale is run by the very young Jackie Fierro. It has no name, but if you need it, you will know where it is. This knowledge will come suddenly, often while you are in the shower. You will collapse, surrounded by a bright, glowing blackness, and you will find yourself on your hands and knees, the warm water running over you, and you will know where the pawn shop is. You will smell must and soap, and feel a stab of panic about how alone you are. It will be like most showers you've taken. Before you can offer Jackie your item, there will first be some hand washing, which is why there are bowls of purified water throughout the shop. You need to chant a little as you wash your hands. You, of course, should always chant when you wash your hands. It is only hygienic. When you have been properly purified, you will lay the item on the counter, and Jackie will consider it. Jackie will have her feet up on the counter. She will lean back. $11, she will say. She will always say, $11. You will not respond. You are, ultimately, unnecessary to this process. You are, ultimately, unnecessary. No, no, she will say, waving her hand. And then she will name her actual price. Usually it is money. Sometimes it is other things. Sometimes it is dreams, experiences, visions. Then you will die, but only for a little while. The item will be given a price tag, $11. Everything in the pawn shop is that price, no matter what she loaned you for it. Once you are no longer dead, she will give you a ticket, which later you will be able to exchange for the item. Or at any time you may look at the ticket and remember the item. Remembering the item is free. You are leaving this story now. You were only an example. And it is probably safer for you not to be in this story anyway. Jackie Fierro squinted out the window at the parking lot. There was no one coming. She was closing soon. Relatively speaking, she was always closing soon, and also always just opening. Beyond the window was the parking lot, and beyond that, the desert, and beyond that, the sky, mostly void, partially stars. Layered from her vantage, it was all distance, equally unreachable from her post at the counter. She had recently turned 19. She had been recently 19 for as long as she could remember. The pawn shop had been hers for a long time, centuries maybe. Clocks and calendars don't work in Night Vale. Time itself doesn't work. For all her years as the newly 19 owner of the pawn shop, she left the shop only when it was closed, and then only to her apartment, where she sat with her feet up on the coffee table, taking in the community radio and the local cable news. Based on what the news told her, the outside world seemed a dangerous place. There was always some world-ending cataclysm threatening Night Vale. Feral dogs, a sentient glowing cloud with the ability to control minds. Although the glow cloud had become less threatening since its election to the local school board. Old oak doors that led to a strange desert otherworld, where the current mayor had been trapped for months. It seemed safer to not have friends or hobbies. To sit at work, head down, doing her job, and then sit at home, glass after glass of orange juice, radio on, safe from anything that might disrupt her routine. Her days were spent in silence, mostly void, partially thought. Some days she would recatalog her inventory. Other days she would clean the shelves. Every day she would sit and think. She would try to think about the day she took over the store. There must have been a day like that. But she could not think of the specifics. She had been doing this for decades. She was very young. Both of these were true at the same time. She knew college was a thing 19-year-olds did. She knew being unemployed in a difficult job market and living at home was a thing other 19-year-olds did. She was content doing neither of those. So she continued on and on and on at the pawn shop. She understood the world and her place in it. She understood nothing. The world and her place in it were nothing, and she understood that. Because of the lack of working time in Night Vale, she went off her gut feeling about when the shop should close. When the feeling came, it came, and the doors had to be locked, removed from their frames, and safely hidden. The feeling came. She swung her feet off the counter. A decent day. Old woman Josie, who lived out by the car lot, had come in with a great number of cheap plastic flamingos. She had carried them in a large canvas sack and emptied them onto the counter like loose change. "It is not for myself that I give up these little ones," said old woman Josie, addressing a bare wall several feet to the right of Jackie in a strong, formal voice, making the occasional sweeping gesture with her palm. "But for the future." Josie stopped, her palm still out. Jackie decided the speech was over. "All right, man, I'll give you $11, she said. Old Woman Josie tightened her eyes at the bare wall. Ah, okay. Jackie softened, prodding at one of the flamingos and looking at its weak plastic belly. Tell you what, I'll give you a good night's sleep. Old Woman Josie shrugged. I'll take it. A good night's sleep was a wildly generous offer. The flamingos were worthless, but there were so many of them, and Jackie couldn't help herself. She never refused an item. Be careful not to touch those directly, Josie said after she was finished being dead. Using shop rags, Jackie laid the flamingos out, side by side, on a shelf, each one tagged with a single, handwritten $11 price tag. Most things shouldn't be touched anyway, Jackie thought. Goodbye, dear, said Josie, taking the ticket that Jackie had filled out. Come by sometime and talk to the angels. They've been asking about you. The angels lived with Old Woman Josie in her small tract home whose tract no longer stood, leaving it alone at the edge of town. The angels did chores for her, and Josie made a modest income selling items they had touched. No one understood why the angels lived with her. Very little was understood about the angels. Some things were. Of course, angels do not exist. It is illegal to consider their existence, or even to give them a dollar when they forget bus money and start hovering around the Ralphs asking for change. The great hierarchy of angels is a foolish dream, and anyway is forbidden knowledge to Night Vale citizens. All of the angels in Night Vale live with Josie out by the car lot. There are no angels in Night Vale. Around the middle of the day, Jackie had acquired a car. It was a Mercedes, only a few years old, and offered with urgency by a young man wearing a gray pinstriped business suit stained with dirt. It was impressive how he got the car onto the counter, but there is a way these things are done, and it had to go on the counter. He washed his hands and chanted. The water went brown and red. She settled on an offer of $5, talking him down from 11, and he laughed as he took the money and the ticket. It's not funny at all, he explained, laughing. And finally, a woman named Diane Creighton arrived late in the afternoon, almost closing time, according to Jackie's gut. Can I help you? Jackie asked. She was unsure why she asked this, as Jackie rarely greeted people who came in the store. Jackie knew who Diane was. She organized PTA fundraisers. Diane sometimes came by to distribute flyers that said things like, Night Vale High School PTA Fund Drive. Help give kids the municipally approved education they deserve. Your support is mandatory and appreciated. Diane, in Jackie's mind, looked just like a woman who would be an active PTA mom, with her kind face and comfortable clothing. She also thought Diane looked like a woman who would be a loan officer, with her conservative makeup choices and serious demeanor. She would look like a pharmacist if she ever were to wear the standard white coat, gas mask, and hip waders. She looked like a lot of things to Jackie. Mostly, she looked like a person lost in both a place and a moment. Diane took a handkerchief from her purse. Without changing her upward, distant expression, she wept a single tear onto the cloth. I'd like to offer this, she said, finally looking at Jackie. Jackie considered the handkerchief. The tear would dry soon. $11, that's the deal, she said. I'll take it, Diane said. Her loose-hanging arms were now drawn up near her purse. Jackie took the tear-dabbed handkerchief and gave Diane her ticket and the money. After her brief death, Diane thanked her and hurried out of the shop. Jackie tagged the tear with its $11 price tag and placed it on a shelf. So, a decent day. Jackie flipped the sign on the door to closed, her hand touching the window, leaving its ghost upon the glass. A hand raised to say, stop, or come here, or hello, or help. Or maybe only, I am here. This hand, at least, is real. She looked down to adjust the items on the counter, and when she looked up, the man was there. He was wearing a tan jacket and holding a deer skin suitcase. He had normal human features. He had arms and legs. He might have had hair, or maybe was wearing a hat. Everything was normal. Hello, he said. My name is Everett. Jackie screamed. The man was perfectly normal. She screamed. I'm sorry, he said. Are you closed?
No, that's okay. No. Can I help you?
Yes, I hope so, he said. There was buzzing coming from somewhere. His mouth? I have an item I would very much like to pawn. She said, and waved her hand to indicate everything she might have said next. He nodded at her hand. Thank you for your help. Have I introduced myself?
No.
Ah, I apologize. My name is Emmett. They shook hands. Her hand continued to shake after he let go. Yes, well, he said. Here is the item. He set a small slip of paper on the counter. On it, written in dull, smeared pencil, were the words, King City. The handwriting was shaky, and the pencil had been pressed down hard. She couldn't stop staring at it, although she didn't know what about it was interesting.
Interesting, she said.
No, not very, said the man in the tan jacket. The man washed his hands and quietly chanted, and Jackie forced herself to lean back and put her feet on the counter. There is a way these things are done. She looked a few times at the man's face, but she found she forgot it the moment she stopped looking.
$11, she said.
The man hummed, and other small voices joined him, apparently from within the deerskin suitcase.
Where did this come from? She asked. Why are you offering it to me? What would I do with it?
Her voice was high and cracked. It did not sound like her at all. The man was now harmonizing with the voices from his suitcase. He did not seem to register her questions.
No, I'm sorry, she said,
fully aware of but unable to stop her poor negotiating technique.
My mistake. $30 and an idea about time.
Done, he said, smiling. Was that a smile? She gave him the $30 and told him her idea about time. That is very interesting, he said. I've never thought of it that way. Generally, I don't think at all. Then he died. She usually used this time to finish up the paperwork, get the ticket ready. She did nothing. She clutched the slip of paper in her hand. He wasn't dead anymore.
I'm sorry, your ticket.
There's no need, he said, still possibly smiling. She couldn't get a good enough look at his face to tell.
No, your ticket. There is a way these things are done.
She scrawled out a ticket with the information tickets always had. A random number, 12,739. The quality of light at the time of transaction, fine. The general feeling of the weather outside, looming. Her current thoughts on the future, looming, but fine. And a quick sketch of what she thought hearts should look like, instead of the pulsing lumps of straw and clay that grow cancer-like into our chests
when we turn 9 years old. He took the ticket as she thrust it at him, and then, thanking her, turned to leave. "Goodbye," she said. "King City," said the paper. "Goodbye," waved the man, saying nothing.
"Wait," she said. "You never told me your name."
"Oh, you're right," he said, hand on door. "My name is Elliot. A pleasure to make your acquaintance." The door swung open and shut. Jackie held the slip of paper in her hand, unsure for the first time in however long her life had been what to do next. She felt that her routine, unbroken for decades, had been disrupted, that something had gone differently. But she also had no idea why she felt that. It was just a slip of paper, just clutched in her hand. Just that. She finished her paperwork. On the line that said, "pawned by," she stopped. She could not remember his name. She couldn't even remember his face. She looked down at the piece of paper. "King City." She looked up to get a glimpse of him out the window, just to jostle her stuck memory. From the counter, she could see the man in the tan jacket outside. He was running out to the desert. She could just barely see him at the edge of the parking lot's radius of light. His arms were swinging wildly, his suitcase swinging along. His legs were flailing, great puffs of sand kicked up behind him, his head thrown back, sweat visible running down his neck even from where she sat. The kind of run that was from something, and not toward. Then he left the faint edge of the light, and was gone.
2. There's this house. It's not unlike many other houses. Imagine what a house looks like. It also looks quite unlike many other houses. Imagine this house again. Given that it is simultaneously not unlike and unlike other houses, it is exactly like all houses. One way it is not unlike other houses is its shape. It has a house-like shape. That's definitely a house, people might say if shown a picture of it. One way it is unlike other houses is also its shape. It has a subtly unnatural shape. That's definitely a house, but there's something else, something beautiful, inside that house, people might say if shown a picture of it. I don't know if beautiful is the right word. It's more like, it's actually upsetting me now. Please stop showing me that picture. Please. Those same people might beg a few moments later. It is a terrible, terrible beauty that I do not understand. Please stop. Okay, the person showing the people the picture might reply, because that person might be good and caring. It is hard to say who is good and caring when you know nothing about a person except that they show other people pictures of houses, but there's no sense in going through life presuming awful things about people you do not know. It would be safe to assume that the house is an enclosed structure owned and built by people. It would be weird to assume that the house has a personality, a soul. Why would anyone assume that? It is true. It does. But that was weird to assume that. Never assume that kind of thing. Another way it is unlike other houses is its thoughts. Most houses do not think. This house has thoughts. Those thoughts are not visible in a picture, nor in person. But they find their way into the world, through dreams, mostly. While a person sleeps, the house might suddenly have a thought. Taupe is not an emotional catalyst. It's practical and bland. No one cries at any shade of taupe.
Or another thought like, OMG, time. What is time even? And the sleeping person might experience that thought too. These thoughts may also be shared in the shower. Grumpy thoughts, angry thoughts, thoughts that should be unthought before interacting with the public. Thoughts like low guttural growl, or knuckles crack, fists clench, teeth tighten, eyes stop letting in any new information, and water runs down a rigid face. The thoughts are everywhere. Sometimes they are quite literal and utilitarian. There's a rodent chewing on some drywall behind the headboard could be one such thought. Another way it is not unlike other houses is that it houses people. It houses a woman, for instance. Imagine a woman. Good work. It also houses a boy, not quite a man. He's 15. You know how it is. Imagine a 15-year-old boy. Nope, that was not right at all. Try again. No. No. Okay, stop. He is tall. He's skinny, with short hair and long teeth that he deliberately hides when he smiles. He smiles more than he thinks he does. Imagine a 15-year-old boy. No, again. No, not close. He has fingers that move like they have no bones. He has eyes that move like he has no patience. He has a tongue that changes shape every day. He has a face that changes shape every day. He has a skeletal structure and coloring and hair that change every day. He seems different than you remember. He is always unlike he was before. Imagine. Good. That's actually pretty good. His name is Josh Creighton. Her name is Diane Creighton. She is Josh's mother. She sees herself in Josh. Josh looks like a lot of things. He changes his physical form constantly. In this way, he is unlike most boys his age. He thinks he is several things at once, many of them contradictory. In this way, he is like most boys his age. Sometimes Josh takes the form of a curve-billed thrasher, or a kangaroo, or a Victorian-era wardrobe. Sometimes he amalgamates his looks, fish head with ivory tusks and monarch wings. You have changed so much since I last saw you, people often say to him. People say that to all teenagers, but they mean it more with Josh. Josh doesn't remember how he looked the last time each person saw him. Like most teenagers, he always was what he happens to be in that moment, until he never was that. There was a girl Josh liked who only liked Josh when he was bipedal. Josh does not like always being bipedal and found this news disappointing. There was a boy Josh liked who liked Josh when he was a cute animal. Josh always likes being a cute animal, but Josh's subjective sense of the word cute was different than the boy's. This was another disappointment for Josh and also for the boy, who did not find giant centipedes cute at all. Diane loved Josh for all of the things he appeared to be. She herself did not change forms, only showing the gradual differences that come with gradual changes of age. Josh sometimes tried to fool Diane by taking the form of an alligator, or a cloud of bats, or a house fire. Diane knew to be on guard at first, just in case there really was a dangerous reptile, or swarm of rabid flying mammals, or a house on fire. But once she understood the situation, she was calm,
and she loved him for who he was and how he looked, no matter what he looked like. She was, after all, the mother of a teenager.
"Please stop shrieking and swarming into the cupboards," she would say. It was important to set boundaries. Josh sometimes appears human. When he does, he is often short, chubby-cheeked, pudgy, wearing glasses.
"Is that how you see yourself, Josh?" Diane once asked.
"Sometimes," Josh replied.
"Do you like the way you look?" Diane once followed up.
"Sometimes," Josh replied.
Diane did not press Josh further. She felt his terse answers were a sign he did not want to talk much. Josh wished his mother talked to him more. His short answers were a sign he didn't know how to socialize well.
"What?"
Josh asked on a Tuesday evening. He had smooth violet skin, a pointed chin, angular, thin shoulders. The television was not on. A textbook was open but not being read. A phone was lit up, a sharp thumb tapping across its keyboard.
"Come talk," Diane said from the cracked door. She did not want to open it all the way.
It was not her room. She was trying very hard. She had sold a tear to Jackie that day. It felt good to have someone explicitly value something that she did. Also, expenses had been higher than usual that month, and she had needed the money. She was, after all, a single parent.
"About what?"
"Anything."
"I'm studying."
"Are you studying? I don't want to bother you if you are studying."
"Ping,"
the phone added.
"If you're studying, then I'll go,"
she said, pretending she did not hear the phone.
"What?"
Josh asked on some other evening. It was a Tuesday, or it was not a Tuesday. His skin was a pale orange, or it was deep navy, or there were thick bristles that plumed from just below his eyes, or his eyes were not visible at all because of the shade of his ram-like horns. This was most evenings. This was the incremental repetition of parenting. The television was not on. A textbook was open but not being read. A phone was lit up.
"How are you doing?"
Diane sometimes said.
Sometimes she said, "What's going on?"
Sometimes she said, "Just checking on you."
"Josh," Diane sometimes said, standing at his door in the evening.
Sometimes she knocked.
"Josh,"
she sometimes repeated following a certain amount of silence.
"Josh,"
she sometimes did not repeat following a second amount of silence.
"Dot, dot, dot,"
Josh sometimes replied. Not out loud, but like in a comic book speech bubble. He pictured other things he could say, but did not know how.
"For the most part, I do not like taffeta," the house thought. And Diane shared that thought.
"Josh," Diane said, sitting in the passenger seat of her burgundy Ford hatchback.
"What?"
said the wolf spider in the driver's seat.
"If you're going to learn to drive, you're going to need to be able to reach the pedals."
The wolf spider elongated, and two of his middle legs extended to the floor of the vehicle, gently touching the pedals.
"And see the road too, Josh."
A human head with the face and hair of a 15-year-old boy emerged from the body of the spider, and the abdomen filled out into something of a primate-like torso. The legs remained spindly and long. He thought he looked cool driving a car as a wolf spider. He did look cool, although it was difficult to control the car. It was important to him that he look cool while driving, although he would not have been able to articulate why. Diane stared him down. Josh took a fully human shape, save for a few feathers on his back and shoulders.
Diane saw them poking out from underneath his shirt sleeves, but decided that not all battles are worth fighting.
Human form when driving the car.
Diane saw herself in Josh. She had been a teenager once. She understood emotions. She empathized. She didn't know with what, but she empathized.
Josh huffed, but Diane reminded him that if he wanted to drive her car, he would play by her rules, which involved not being a 3-inch-long wolf spider.
Diane reminded him of his bike and how that was a perfectly reasonable form of transportation. Diane's task of teaching her son to drive took additional patience, not just because of Josh's insistence on constant reassessment of his physical identity, but also because the car was a manual transmission. Imagine teaching a 15-year-old how to drive a car with manual transmission. First, you have to press down the clutch. Then, you have to whisper a secret into one of the cup holders. In Diane's case, this was easy, as she was not a very social or public person, and most any mundane thing in her life could be a secret. In Josh's case, this was hard, because for teenagers, most every mundane thing in their lives is a secret that they do not like sharing in front of their parents. Then, after the clutch and the secret, the driver has to grab the stick shift, which is a splintered wood stake wedged into the dashboard, and shake it until something happens. Anything, really. And then simultaneously type a series of code numbers into a keyboard on the steering wheel. All this while sunglasses-wearing agents from a vague yet menacing government agency sit in a heavily tinted black sedan across the street taking pictures, and occasionally waving. This is a lot of pressure on a first-time driver.
Josh often got frustrated with his mother. This was because Diane was not the best teacher. This was also because Josh was not the best student. There were other reasons as well.
"Josh, you need to listen to me," Diane would say. I get it, okay?
Josh would say, not getting it at all. Diane enjoyed arguing with Josh about driving because it was time spent talking, having a relationship. It was not easy being a mother to a teenager. Josh enjoyed this time too, but not consciously. On the surface, he was miserable. He just wanted to drive a car, not do all of the things it takes to be able to drive a car, like having a car and learning to drive it. And sometimes he would say, "Why can't my dad come teach me?" Because he knew that question hurt her. Then he would feel bad about hurting her. Diane would feel bad, too. They would sit in the car, feeling bad.
"You're doing a good job," Diane once said to Josh, in relation to nothing, only trying to fill a silence.
"So every other time I'm not doing a good job," Josh thought, because he didn't understand the context of her statement.
"Thanks," Josh said out loud, trying to fill the silence with graciousness. "You still need to work on a lot of things," Diane did not say. "I'm sorry your father isn't here," she also did not say. "But I am trying so, so hard. I am, Josh. I am. I am. I am,"
she did not say. As far as things go, her self-control was pretty good.
"I'm really good at driving," Josh often thought, even as he veered too close to highway barriers, rolled wheels up on curbs, and failed to yield to hooded figures, resulting in mandatory citywide ennui for hours. Nightvale's traffic laws are Byzantine and kept on a need-to-know basis with civilian drivers. Their driving lessons often ended in a "good job" and a thanks, and a brief pause and a divergence into separate silent rooms. Later, Diane would knock and say, Josh? And Josh would or would not reply. Diane hurt. She was not consciously aware that she hurt, but she hurt. Josh? She said, so many times a day, for so many different reasons. Josh loved his mother, but he did not know why. Diane loved her son, and she did not care why. Another way the house is unlike other houses is it has a faceless old woman secretly living in it, although that is not important to this story. 3. King City, said the paper. Jackie had never felt fear in her entire life. She had felt caution and unease and sadness and joy, which are all similar to fear, but she had never felt fear itself. She did not feel it then. She got to the work of closing, wiping down the bathroom sink, sweeping the floor, and adjusting the thick burlap covering up items that were forbidden or secret, like the time machine that Larry Leroy had stolen from the Museum of Forbidden Technologies, and the pens and pencils, writing utensils having long been outlawed in Nightvale for reasons of public well-being, although everyone still surreptitiously used them. The paper was still in her hand. She hadn't realized it, had been going about everything without realizing, but there it was. Still there. Dull pencil, smudged, hurried handwriting. She put it down on the cracked glass of the countertop. Now it was time to feed those items that were alive. Some of the items were alive. Some of them were dogs, and some weren't. There were lights now, in the desert. Low bubbles of light coming and going. She had never seen them before. She ignored them, as she ignored all things that were not part of the small circle of her days. There were always things she had never seen before in Nightvale. There was the man she passed in the desert using a pair of scissors on the top of a cactus, as if he were cutting its hair. There was the cactus that had a full head of hair. There was the day where the small crack that's always visible in the sky suddenly opened up, and several pterodactyls flew out. Later, it was revealed they were just pteranodons, and all the panic was for nothing. She finished her check of the inventory. The paper was in her hand. King City, said the paper. How did it get there? How did this get here? She asked. The dogs did not respond, nor did anything less sentient. She put the paper in a drawer in the back room, in the desk she did not use for the work she did not have. There was nothing more to be done to close the shop. If she were honest, and she tried to be, she had been looking for excuses not to leave. If she were honest, and she tried to be, the floor had been clean enough to begin with. A glance out the window, the low bubbles of light in the desert were gone. Nothing there, but a distant airplane crawling across the sky, red blinking lights, vulnerable in the vast empty, faint red beacons flashing the message, Hello, a small island of life up here, very close to space. Pray for us. Pray for us. The paper was in her hand. King City, the paper said. Jackie felt fear for the first time, and she did not know what it was. For the first time in a long time, she wished she had a friend to call. She had had friends in high school. She knew that, although the memory of high school was distant and vague. The rest of her friends hadn't stopped at 19. They had gotten older, living full lives. They had tried to stay in touch, but it was difficult as they moved on to adult careers and kids and retirement, and Jackie just kept being 19 years old.
So, still 19,
Noelle Connolly had said when they spoke on the phone for the final time. Her disapproval was clear in her voice.
Oh, Jackie, do you ever just think of turning 20?
They had been friends since sophomore Spanish class, but Noelle had been 58 at the point she had finally asked Jackie that question, and spoke in tones that felt sickeningly parental to Jackie. Jackie had said so, and Noelle had become openly condescending. And they had both hung up, and she and Noelle had never spoken again. People who grow older think they are so wise, she thought, like time means anything at all. The radio came on by itself as she stood there, paper in hand. It always did at this time of night. Cecil Palmer, the host of Night Vale Community Radio, spoke to her. News, the community calendar, traffic. She listened when she could to Cecil. Most of the town did. At home, Jackie had a small radio, only about 2 feet wide, a foot and a half tall. It was the lightweight, portable edition, under 14 pounds, with a mother-of-pearl handle and sharply angled, open-beaked eagles carved into the upper corners. Her mother had gotten it for her whenever her 16th birthday was, however long ago that had been, and it was one of Jackie's favorite possessions, along with her record collection, which she never listened to because she didn't have a license to own a record player yet. Cecil Palmer spoke of the horrors of everyday life. Nearly every broadcast told a story of impending doom or death or worse, a long life lived in fruitless fear of doom or death. It wasn't that Jackie wanted to know all of the bad news of the world. It was that she loved sitting in the dark of her bedroom, swaddled in blankets and invisible radio waves. Look, life is stressful. This is true everywhere. But life in Night Vale is more stressful. There are things lurking in the shadows. Not the projections of a worried mind, but literal things. Lurking, literally, in shadows. Conspiracies are hidden in every storefront, under every street, and floating in helicopters above. And with all that, there is still the bland tragedy of life. Births, deaths, comings, goings, the gulf of subjectivity and bravado between us and everyone we care about. All is sorrow, as a man once said without really doing much about it. But when Cecil talked, it was possible to let some of that go, to let go of the worries, to let go of the questions, to let go of letting or going. The slip of paper, however, Jackie could not let go of. She opened her hand and watched it flutter to the floor. She stared at it. It was on the floor. Dot, dot, dot. The blank back of the paper said, not literally, but like in a comic book speech bubble. She stared and stared, and it sat and sat. And then she blinked her eyes, and it was back in her hand. King City. It said. This is getting me nowhere, she said to no one, or to the dogs, or to the thing that lurked in her corner. She tried calling Cecil at the station to see if he had heard anything about a man in a tan jacket holding a deerskin suitcase. She couldn't remember Cecil ever mentioning a person by that description on his show, but it was worth a shot. One of the station interns picked up, promising to take a message, but who knew if the poor kid would even survive long enough to deliver it?
That's okay, Jackie said. Hey, listen, I think the Arby's is hiring. Have you considered that? Their death rate is really low for the area.
But the kid was already hanging up. Oh, well, not Jackie's job to worry about the life of someone foolhardy enough to be a community radio intern. The shop was well and truly closed. At this point, if she waited any longer, she might as well lay out a sleeping bag and spend the night, which, nope. So she stepped out into the parking lot, jumpy for sure. There was a black sedan with tinted windows at the end of the lot. The windows cracked down enough for her to see two sunglassed agents of a vague yet menacing government agency watching her intently. One of them had a camera that kept going off, but the agent didn't seem to know how to deactivate the flash. The light against the tinted window made the shots worthless, and the agent cursed and tried again, and it flashed again. Jackie waved goodnight to them, as she always did. Maybe she would take the Mercedes home, drive with the roof down, see how fast she could make it go before the sheriff's secret police stopped her. But she wouldn't, of course. She walked to her car, a blue Mazda coupe with double red stripes that had been washed, presumably, at some point before she owned it. King City, she said. The paper in her hand agreed. It had been a mistake to accept what the man in the tan jacket had offered her. She didn't know what it was, or what it meant, or what information it was trying to convey, and to whom. But she knew that it had changed something. The world was slipping into her life, and she had to push it out, starting with this slip of paper and the man in the tan jacket. She announced her intentions, as all Nightvale citizens must. I will find the man in the tan jacket, and I will make him take this piece of paper back, she announced. If I could do that without having to learn anything about him or what the paper means, that would be just ideal. The agents in the car, holding index fingers to earpieces, dutifully wrote this down. Out in the desert, bubbles of light low to the ground. The echo of a crowd arguing and then cheering. For a moment, a tall building, all glass and angles and business, where there had definitely been nothing but sand. And then it was gone. And there were more lights, shifting, warping the air around them. And the echo of crowds and the lights. She put the car in reverse and pulled onto the highway, tossing the slip of paper out the window and watching with satisfaction as it fluttered into the night behind her. And then, snapping her fingers, caught the paper between them, where it was, where it had always been. The Voice of Nightvale. Hello, listeners. Cecil here. Your voice from the darkness. The quiet whisper in your empty night, speaking to you now from a booth at the Nightvale Community Radio Station. Here to bring you all the news and community goings-on that you need to know, and hide from you all forbidden and dangerous knowledge. Now, the news. There are lights above our town, Nightvale. I am not talking here about the stars. No one knows what the stars are or what they intend, but they have remained in mostly the same order and have indicated no harm for as long as anyone around here can remember. Astronomers keep trying to explain that stars are distant suns in distant galaxies, but of course you have to take everything astronomers say with a grain of salt. But these new lights are not stars. They are low bubbles of light coming and going overhead. They are not the same lights that sometimes hover hundreds of feet above the Arby's. Those lights are different. We understand those lights. The new lights, however, are concerning. Witnesses reported the lights change colors when commented on. Some people would say things like, "Oh, look at those orange lights," and then point. And suddenly the lights would be yellow, and those people's friends would then respond, "No, that's definitely a yellow." But then they'd go back to being orange, and so on. That was one such witness account given by Chris Brady and Stuart Robinson of Old Town Night Vale. Chris added, "What do you think? They're orange, right?" The lights then turned yellow again, and Stuart concluded with, "Why is it so important for you to always be right, Christopher?" before storming off, followed by a very apologetic Chris. So far, the lights seem harmless, unless you're directly under them, in which case they're the opposite of harmless, whatever that means to you. Last night, at a press conference, the City Council reminded everyone that the dog park is there for our community enjoyment and use, and so it is important that no one enter, look at, or think about the dog park. They are adding a new advanced camera system to keep an eye on the great black walls of the dog park at all times, and if anyone is caught trying to enter it, they will be forced to enter it and will never be heard from again. If you see hooded figures in the dog park, no, you didn't. The hooded figures are perfectly safe and should not be approached at any costs. The City Council ended the conference by devouring a raw potato in quick, small bites of their sharp teeth and rough tongues. No follow-up questions were asked, although there were a few follow-up screams. We've also received word via encrypted radio pulses about the opening of a new store. Lenny's Bargain House of Garden Wares and Machine Parts, which until recently was that abandoned warehouse the government was using for the highly classified and completely secret tests I was telling you about last week. Lenny's will serve as a helpful new source for all needs involving landscaping and lawn decorating materials, and also as a way for the government to unload all the machines and failed tests and dangerous substances that otherwise would be wasted on things like safe disposal or burying in a concrete tomb until the sun goes out. Get out to Lenny's for their big grand opening sale. Find 8 government secrets and get a free kidnapping and personality reassignment so that you'll forget you found them. And now, it's time for the Children's Fun Fact Science Corner. Here is what we know about sentience. Sand is sentient. The desert is sentient. The sky is not sentient. Plants are intermittently sentient. Dogs are the most sentient. We are not sentient. The planet as a whole is sentient. The parts that make up that whole are not sentient. Holes are sentient. We are not sentient. Gift cards are sentient until they expire. States in which it is illegal for gift cards to expire have created immortal sentience. Money is not sentient. The concept of private property is sentient. Sand is sentient. The desert is sentient. We are not sentient. This has been the Children's Fun Fact Science Corner. Is your identity safe, listeners? With so much information being stored in databases these days, it's uncertain how we can feel secure that our identities are our own. There are scams galore to try to steal your credit card numbers, social security numbers, city citizen personal numbers, neighborhood resident tracking numbers, and so on. Not a week goes by where we don't hear of some database being cracked open like a fresh egg on a granite countertop and personal information spilling everywhere. For identity thieves to just lap up like a dog who's allowed to be on the kitchen counter and who likes raw eggs. Here are some tips for protecting your identity, Night Vale.